Three times in the past 30 years, Arizona's Secretary of State has moved up to the governor's ninth floor office without being elected. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with the two nominees for Secretary of State who are on next month's ballot, Democrat Terry Goddard and Republican Michelle Reagan. We'll find out their views on voter fraud and voter suppression and what issues they'll be outspoken about. Also, law enforcement in Arizona is trying to improve how it deals with situations that involve people with mental illness. We'll find out how it's supposed to work and what training should be included. Plus, the cities of Phoenix and Tucson have announced a water-sharing agreement. We'll get details. And are too many liberal arts students focused on their own creative outlets instead of having bigger ideas? I'll talk to Professor Stephen Tepper. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. More details are emerging today about the first Ebola patient diagnosed in the United States with the virus. He's said to be in serious condition in isolation at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas. The patient's been there since Sunday. At a news conference Governor Rick Perry held a short time ago, Dr. Mark Lester with Texas Health Resources acknowledged a breakdown in communication within the clinical team that earlier had not diagnosed Ebola, even though a nurse had initially followed a checklist of questions.
That nurse was part of a care team, and it was a complex care team taking care of him in the emergency department. Regretfully, that information was not fully communicated throughout the full team. And as a result, the full import of that information wasn't factored into the clinical decision making.
In Dallas, health officials are watching carefully for any other cases of Ebola. NPR's Wade Goodwin says a close eye is being kept on people the current patient had been in contact with.
County and federal health officials understood that close associates of the first case of Ebola in Dallas were at serious risk of being infected. The Ebola patient, who traveled to Dallas from Liberia earlier this month, had contact with children who are now being kept home and closely monitored. Dallas Independent School District officials say they are working closely with the Dallas County Health Department, but that there is currently no evidence for concern. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
A respiratory virus that can start out like the common cold and quickly become serious is now linked to a child's death in Rhode Island. The state's health department says a 10-year-old girl from Cumberland died last week from complications of a staph infection associated with enterovirus D68, an unusual and dangerous combination, according to experts. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has confirmed hundreds of cases in 41 states and the District of Columbia. However, officials stress that few people who contract enterovirus D68 will experience anything more than a low fever or runny nose. Spain has indicted five of its soldiers for alleged prison torture in Iraq. Lauren Frey reports from Madrid. The case took 10 years to prosecute.
The men are accused of beating Iraqi prisoners at a Spanish military base in Diwania, Iraq, in 2004. Spain had troops in Iraq briefly before pulling them out later that year. The suspects were identified from a grainy video recorded inside a prison cell there. The graphic clip shows Spanish soldiers repeatedly kicking an Iraqi prisoner who whimpers in a fetal position on the floor of a cement cell. The video surfaced last year, and it took investigators a year and a half to identify the men. They face up to 25 years in prison if convicted. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Madrid.
Dow is sliding 239 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Relativity Media, with Hector and the Search for Happiness. Simon Pegg is on a global quest to uncover true happiness, now playing in select theaters.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. The former speaker of the Navajo Nation Council has pleaded guilty in a scheme to funnel nearly $37,000 in tribal funds to his family. Johnny Nays entered the plea Tuesday to conspiracy to commit bribery. He resigned as speaker on Monday and will be sentenced to probation, community service, and possibly jail time. Nays had been scheduled to go on trial in October. The Department of Energy has released a plan to resume operations at the nation's only permanent nuclear waste repository. KJZZ's Monica Ortiz-Uribe reports the reopening is scheduled for early 2016.
The waste isolation pilot plant in southeast New Mexico closed in February after an underground truck fire, followed by a radiation leak 9 days later. The WIP facility stores waste left over from nuclear weapons production. The recovery plan includes installing a new ventilation system and adding steel rods to improve the stability of the underground storage rooms. Mark Whitney with the Department of Energy says progress is ongoing.
Over 50% of the underground is clean and stable.
The estimated cost of recovery is $240 million. Whitney said a report detailing the cause of the initial radiation leak will be out by the end of the year. Monica Ortiz Uribe, KJZZ News, El Paso.
Jury selection resumes today in the penalty phase of the Jodi Arias trial. Arias was convicted of murder last year in the 2008 killing of her ex-boyfriend at his suburban Phoenix home, but jurors couldn't agree on a sentence. On Monday, about 100 potential jurors were dismissed after telling a judge they had seen too much media coverage of her first trial to be impartial or had already made up their minds about her punishment. Another 100 prospective jurors will be called in today.
KJZZ is supported by Central Arizona Project in partnership with SRP to manage and deliver reliable and sustainable water supplies to our desert communities. More about how to conserve and use water wisely at centralarizonaproject.com.
Look for sunny skies in Phoenix today, a high of 90 degrees. It'll be clear overnight with a low of 69. Right now, under sunny skies, it's 82 degrees in Phoenix. The time is 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll find out what law enforcement agencies in Arizona are changing about how they deal with people in a mental health crisis. Also, the mayors of Phoenix and Tucson have announced a water use agreement. We'll get details from Caitlin McGlade of the Arizona Republic. We start today's program with the two finalists for Arizona's second highest office, Secretary of State, Democrat Terry Goddard and Republican Michelle Reagan. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
This won't be a formal debate, but the candidates have been asked not to directly address each other, and we'll give them as close to equal time as possible. Mr. Goddard, we'll start with you. To what extent does Arizona have either a voter fraud or a voter suppression problem?
We've got a big voter suppression problem, and I think you only have to look at the voter turnout numbers. We don't have to get into details. Just look at 46th in the nation in voter turnout and falling. So something is seriously wrong. Our voting system is a mess, and a huge number of eligible citizens who could vote in Arizona are not doing it. So that speaks to me volumes about what the problems might be. And I can point to a number of them, but let's start with independents. Independent voters in Arizona feel left out. And they don't just feel left out, they are left out. If you want to run for statewide office as an independent, you need 33,000 signatures. If you run as a Democrat or Republican, you need about 6,500, 7,000 signatures. That's not fair. If you want to get an early ballot, a mail ballot in the primary, an independent has to request one every single election. A Republican or Democrat get one automatically. That's a system that in its execution is just not treating independents fairly. And I could go on, but your nod indicates that it's time to relinquish the floor.
Ms. Reagan, let me ask you the same question, and we'll have a follow-up as well. But in terms of voter fraud or voter suppression, does Arizona have a problem in either area?
I think that we definitely need to be very wary when we see a 27% turnout in primary elections. Completely dismal. And would love to see that increased. And it would be nice to see that doubled, and that would still put us too low, I think. There are barriers to independents voting in primary systems, and that's actually something that I've put out in a plan that I would like to see the barriers removed, what the extra steps they have to take. But I'm also very, very concerned about what I call ballot harvesting and some of the things that we see happening in this state that we don't see happening in any other state. Or if they do see it happening in other states, it's been corrected and not allowed in any of the other states. And so it's twofold. It's making sure that our system is as free from fraud as possible, and then making sure that as many people are voting as possible that are eligible to vote.
Let me follow up with you quickly. Ballot harvesting, define that for our listeners.
That is where we have individuals going door to door in various neighborhoods and saying, hi, I'm here to collect your early ballot. And where people are turning over their ballots to third parties, whether it's a candidate or a campaign operative, or sometimes party operatives, and they're collecting ballots and holding on to them until the day of the election and walking into a polling place on election day and turning in hundreds, if not thousands, of ballots.
And why is that in and of itself a problem?
Because there's a chain of custody, or should be a chain of custody, with ballots. Those ballots are people's voices. And you do not turn, you should not be turning over your ballot to somebody that you do not know. Now, there should be a way or a mechanism, and there can be a very safe mechanism for someone who can't get their ballot in. Let's say you have an elderly neighbor, or you have somebody that is ill and can't get their ballot into the polls. But the mail-in system is just that. It is meant to be mailed back in. And no other state in the country allows an individual to walk into a polling place on Election Day and turn in 1,000 ballots.
Mr. Goddard, your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that, A, you have to move forward with actual evidence, and there have been no evidence of fraud or adulteration of ballots. I believe a reasonable limit is for an individual is appropriate, and what Senator Reagan said about holding on to them for a long period of time is illegal under Arizona law. So we need to enforce that law. If, in fact, people are holding ballots, that's wrong, that's illegal, shouldn't happen. Let's look for the evidence, and let's make sure that we are careful about securing our system. And, you know, I'm a prosecutor and a law enforcement officer for much of my career. I believe you have to make sure that the locks are solid and the doors are firm, using the White House example these days, and just to make sure that the most important system that we have, our voting rights, is carefully protected, and that every vote is counted, and every voter is treated absolutely fairly. I think the Secretary of State needs to send out a loud and clear message that it doesn't matter whether you're a D, an R, an I, or whatever name, whatever party comes after your name, that you're going to be treated absolutely fairly and equally by the Secretary of State. That's not the message that's been sent by the current incumbent. He's been an active partisan. He's endorsed and campaigned for a Republican candidate for president. He's involved in a lot of stunts that are purely political, and that's wrong. I'm absolutely committed that if I'm Secretary of State, I'm not endorsing anybody. I'm not going to put my finger on to try to favor any particular party. I think that sends a terrible message to Arizonans who are already discouraged about the system.
Ms. Reagan, a short follow-up there?
That is something that I think is incumbent upon any Secretary of State going forward, is that we do not get involved in campaigns, that we do not endorse. That office of any statewide office should be the one office that is completely nonpartisan. That is an office that is for the people.
Mr. Goddard, next formal question, I'll come to you again on this one. The dual-track voting system has some people concerned based on whether there is a federal ballot, whether there's a state ballot, based on someone proving citizenship or not. We're always worried about budgeting. Turns out there were county issues where people were paying tens of thousands of dollars for ballots that weren't even used. Start with you for a short answer. Dual-track voting system going forward, what should Arizona be doing? Where does the Secretary of State fit in?
Well, I think the Secretary of State fits in right in the middle of this particular issue, because it was the current Secretary of State who established this system by fiat. He simply said, and I think June of this year, there will be a two-track system. It will involve a so-called federal and a state ballot. That system, although the numbers aren't final, apparently cost us as Arizona taxpayers $2 million. Extraordinarily expensive for 21 voters. The only voters that took a federal ballot were 21 people in the state of Arizona. So it's an extraordinary cost. You know, figure out the cost per voter for this particular experiment. Only two states in the nation use the federal state standard. That's Kansas and Arizona. And we've been following Kansas, unfortunately, to our detriment on a number of things. Chris Kovacs, who's the Secretary of State there, wrote Senate Bill 1070 and sold it in Arizona, said it was constitutional. He was wrong on virtually every point. And now he sold us on this dual-track balloting, which, let's be very, very clear about who gets frozen out of the system because of the dual track. It's students at ASU and U of A who are from out of state and don't happen to have the necessary paperwork. They don't happen to have their birth certificate with them. So they now vote just for federal offices. And this year, that means only for Congress. So they can't vote for any other offices that the rest of us citizens can do. I think that's wrong. I think it has to be taken away. I think we need to learn from the other states in the country who also have citizenship requirements before you can register to vote, but don't have this very expensive and silly two-track system.
Ms. Reagan?
Well, this issue is a very unfortunate that our state is caught between two laws that conflict with each other. And I think it's very important to note that whether we like the dual-track system or not, It is an unfortunate fact that we are trapped between a law that the people of Arizona voted on and that the federal government set, you know, upon us. And these two laws conflict. And we as a state, Arizona, are in a unique and unfortunate position of having to satisfy two laws that don't match up. And so the dual track system was something that the Attorney General's office issued an opinion and said, this is the only way we can come up with of how to satisfy these two laws. And going forward, this will be settled by the courts. It's already in the court system. And the decision is actually expected to be rendered on November 3rd. So hopefully going forward after this election, it will already be decided which law is Arizona and Kansas and 36 other states that have similar type voter registration and voter ID laws, what are they supposed to follow? So hopefully going forward, this dual track system was not supposed to be a long-term, you know, solution. It was a kind of a Band-Aid on a very unfortunate problem that Arizona was facing.
It's basically not a solution at all. Okay. 34 other states have the same basic requirement that Arizona have, and they didn't embark on this voter suppressing and hugely expensive. Let me get back to that. Hugely expensive. In a state that is so budget strapped as Arizona is today, and I think we can take that as a given, to spend $2 million on 21 voters is an extraordinary waste.
Just as a quick follow-up, Steve, important to note that 34 other states didn't have the voter mandate that Arizona and Kansas had. That's the important difference. That's why Arizona and Kansas are in the court system, is because we had the added layer of a voter-approved initiative. That is very, very powerful. Keep in mind that when the voters approve something in our state, that is the highest level, the gold standard. That is something that the legislature can't go in and just change. So that means that, I mean, that is a very, very powerful law. That is why it sets us apart from the 34 other states that have such laws.
Actually, it doesn't, because the other states are paying attention to Congress and federal law. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, sitting on the Ninth Circuit, in an opinion about this issue, basically made the decision. She's a former Arizona legislator. She's certainly somebody who knows our laws. She basically said, look, you've got a federal registration requirement. You have a different set of standards for the state. You've got to accommodate both, because unless or the federal will trump. So right now, 34 other states have waited to find what the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals is going to decide on this issue. As Senator Reagan said, they're going to issue their opinion soon. I think it would have been wise to wait until you see what the courts say before we spent $2 million for 21 people.
Would you like one more very quick follow, or should I move on?
I just absolutely support showing ID when registering to vote. So,
yeah, but that's not the issue. The issue is whether you have to have this silly two-track system, and
okay.
I oppose it.
Well, let's move on. Senator Reagan, let me start with you on this one. Why should we want more Arizonans to vote? And what sort of leadership should the Secretary of State take with that in terms of getting, you've both mentioned the idea of getting more people into vote by having 80%, or recently in Scotland we saw close to 90% right. of people voting. In and of itself, that sounds like a great thing. Why is it, and what steps would you want to take to make sure we do get more and more Arizonans, not just 50%, but 75%, 80% voting?
Why would we want it? Obviously, when the greater number of people that vote, the more voices we add to the decisions that are being made. And any time that we have more of a collection of voices, we're going to get a better decision. We see that. I see that down at my time at, you know, from my time at the legislature. Every time that I'm writing a bill or that I'm working on legislation, the more voices that are added to making that decision, the better the product. Even when it's voices, and usually when it's voices that don't agree with me, that's when I get a better outcome. So more people voting is always going to be better. How can the Secretary of State do that? We're going to be releasing a plan later today that outlines ways that the Secretary of State can encourage that. And they don't always have to involve legislation, and that's the great part.
Can't you give us a scoop?
I can give you a little tidbits, sure. Voting kiosks at high schools where students can register to vote before they're 18, so that on the day that they turn 18, their voting registration card shows up in the mail. the implementation at the Secretary of State's office of a voting rights ambassador, somebody that is actually in the communities working to make sure that minority voting rights aren't trampled and that are watching voting processes, you know, up on the Navajo reservation, making sure that there's in their language, in the Navajo language, that making sure that people are included and they understand the election process in the communities. There are so many ways to increase voter turnout that don't require legislation.
Mr. Goddard, why do we want more people voting, and what ideas would you have for getting more people to vote?
Well, first off, Vox Populi, Vox Dei, basically the voice of the people is what our democracy is all about. And when you end up with these tiny fractions of the total eligible voter actually at the polls, I think you get what we have in Arizona today. You get an extremely divided legislature, you have nobody playing to the middle, and you have only extremes voting. That's bad for us. That's bad for our state going forward. It sounds like Senator Reagan has some good ideas, but she has been the head of the Senate Elections Committee, and her party has controlled this office for decades now. My question is, why is the system such a mess today? Why are so many voters feeling that they have been shoved out of the system? And one of the reasons is a voter suppression bill that she wrote and championed and brought through the legislature in 2013. And that was one which basically made it harder to do an initiative and referendum, basically tried to eliminate the Libertarian Party based on the number of signatures that they would need to get on a statewide ballot, made independents more difficult to vote, and essentially made voting and voting processes harder in the state of Arizona. That's not moving in the direction of opening up the process and getting more fellow Arizonans to the polls. So I think we need to do exactly that. It's critical.
Since we're up against the clock, Ms. Reagan, you have a chance to either respond to that or give us sort of a closing statement, whichever you prefer.
I would just like to say that there were portions of 2305. There was five main portions, and the three portions that I wrote were actually supported by 15 county recorders, and all 15 county recorders voted in a unanimous and bipartisan fashion. 15 county recorders, 9 Democrats and 6 Republicans voted to support that legislation. So, some parts of it were not as good as others, but the parts I wrote were very bipartisan and still legislation I believe in today.
And you have another 30 seconds or so if you'd like it? Okay.
Just, I've worked very hard on two main components in the legislature over my 12 years down there, and that's been elections and business. I was the chair of the Commerce Committee for many years in the House, and now in the Senate, I have been the chair of the Elections Committee for the past 2 years. Two areas of law that I'm extremely passionate about and enjoy, and that is the exact role of the Secretary of State's office. So I'm very excited to get up there and start working for the people of the state of Arizona.
Mr. Goddard, up to 1 minute for you.
Thank you. Just to correct the record, I mean, the fact is 2305 was a unity. Senator Reagan voted for the whole thing and only backed off when 150,000 Arizonans signed petitions to put it on the ballot. And then all of a sudden, she and the leaders in the legislature didn't think it was such a good idea anymore, and they repealed it. So it's not the law today, but it's only because citizens took the bit in their teeth and moved to stop it. Now, I'm running for this office for the reasons we've talked about, plus one more. Obviously, to get more Arizonans to the polls, to get more people participating, because they believe that the system is fair, that their vote will be counted, and that, in fact, nobody is trying to influence the system one way or the other. I think fairness has got to be the absolute hallmark of the Secretary of State's office. The other is dark money, and we don't have time to go into it, but I am absolutely adamant that Arizona is getting a terrible rap because we've become a place where anonymous corporate cash runs rampant. Over $5 million in the last primary. It's got to be stopped. Secretary of State needs to lead the fight for transparency.
Terry
thank
Goddard,
you very much.
Michelle Reagan, thank you so much for being here, the two finalists for Secretary of State of Arizona. Nice
thank
to have you.
Thank you.
Here. Still
thank
to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about how law enforcement is dealing with people who have mental health crises. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts. Grammy Award winner Branford Marsalis performs Baroque masterpieces with the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. Sunday, October 19th, scottsdaleperformingarts.org.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. On the Valley Freeways right now, on the State Route 143 southbound, there's a crash blocking the on-ramp at Washington Street. Sunny skies across most of the state right now. It's 61 degrees in Flagstaff, 70 in Prescott, 82 in Casa Grande, Tucson reporting 81 degrees, and it's 88 in Yuma. Stay with us at 1 this afternoon for BBC NewsHour. That's followed at 2 by The World. Sunny skies and 82 degrees in Phoenix at 11:25.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The way police officers deal with people who may be involved in a mental health crisis has become a frequently discussed issue. In the 2014 legislative session, Arizona lawmakers passed and the governor signed House Bill 2105, which, among other things, takes witness statements into account when determining whether to take someone experiencing a mental health crisis into custody. In a few minutes, we'll talk about that with S.E. Smith and Jim Dunn. Earlier, I spoke with Sergeant Jason Winsky of the Mental Health Investigative Support Team for the Tucson Police Department to find out how the department has implemented the law's changes into its training and policies.
We're a central location for all of the cases and for all of the issues that come up in our community that involve both law enforcement and mental health issues. We've centralized the process of serving mental health court orders, which means that highly trained police personnel are responding in our community and transporting people who need to be transported to mental health facilities. We also do follow-up investigations whenever police officers or community members, co-workers, maybe family members contact the police department, and they tell us that someone in the community needs more attention or needs services they aren't receiving.
When you have members of law enforcement involved in this, what are some things that they needed to be more aware of and even do better when it comes to situations that they face involving folks who have mental illness?
The Mental Health Investigative Support Team is staffed by veteran officers. All have been through crisis intervention team training. And what crisis intervention training focuses on, it's a 40-hour class. It focuses on crisis communication and de-escalation. And what that actually means is how to talk to people in the community who are in some level of crisis. It might be a behavioral health crisis. It might be a crisis related to the loss of a job or the death of a loved one. And we're able to communicate with those people more effectively to de-escalate those situations away from physical confrontations and towards peaceful solutions.
I guess I'm wondering if that training, how challenging the training is, considering what officers have to deal with and how they've been trained to deal with other situations.
Crisis intervention team training is pretty rigorous. It involves a lot of collaboration with the behavioral health community. They actually help bring role players to scenario-based training who act out people or who are having a behavioral health crisis. And we make the officers and the police personnel, even our dispatchers, communications workers, people who fulfill those roles in the police department, go through that training. And it's a real eye-opener when you have that training to see from the other side, from the other perspective, what it's like for the person who's in that crisis, who might not be making the rational decisions that they're normally capable of making.
Is their behavior noticeably different through the training, or are they relatively calm when it comes to this and hoping to calm the person who's having the mental health crisis?
Well, we train our officers never to compromise officer safety. That being said, the training really emphasizes and focuses on walking into the door or responding to that call, immediately doing an assessment right at the beginning of the situation to determine kind of like which hat am I wearing here? Is this a criminal call? Is this a robbery? Is this a burglary? Is this a suspect that I'm dealing with? Or is this a behavioral health crisis? Am I dealing with a person who has not necessarily committed a crime, but is having some kind of emotional or mental breakdown or crisis to where they need to get placed into treatment or into services immediately? As we move forward as law enforcement, and we know that we're going to deal more and more with people in mental health crisis, we're going to have to respond in a differentiated way.
Even though House Bill 2105 passed easily and really with very little opposition, I know there are some who are concerned that it could be unfair to people who are having mental illness crisis. It may not be able to determine their own fate, may not be able to talk with officers in that sense, and that a lot of weight is put on what folks have witnessed as far as the behavior goes. What are your thoughts about that? Is there a situation where that could end up being a problem, or is that part of the training as well to know to deal with the situation and listen to witnesses, but not necessarily completely take everything they've said 100%.
You know, the whole idea, as it were, of taking hearsay and using that to make judgments about how an investigation or how a circumstance is going to conclude is nothing new to police officers. Quite frankly, it's something we've been doing since there were police officers, whether it's a burglary or a robbery, you know, speaking with witnesses, taking statements, and really considering what we would call the totality of the circumstances. The last thing a police officer ever really wants to do would be to force someone to a treatment facility or to force someone into a treatment plan that doesn't really belong there. But there's a lot of checks and balances in between those. The behavioral health community, you know, certainly the doctors, the physicians, the psychiatrists, the therapists, there's a lot of go-betweens in between forcing someone into a treatment plan and the police officer who's out there on the street. But that's not what we're really seeing when we're out there. What we're seeing as police officers out there are neighbors, coworkers, and family members who are afraid to directly make that report that there is a neighbor or a son or a daughter who's in a behavioral health crisis and needs to be taken to a treatment facility. And they're afraid to step forward and put their name on the paperwork or to testify necessarily in court if that were necessary. And so the result of that is the person doesn't get services and they don't go to a treatment facility. And that negatively impacts not just the individual who's in crisis, but the community at large. I think what this new legislation does is it just gives us one more tool to connect people to treatment and services who desperately need it.
That's Sergeant Jason Winsky of the Tucson Police Department's Mental Health Investigative Support Team. It's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. For other perspectives on law enforcement officers dealing with people having a mental health crisis, I'm joined by Jim Dunn, Executive Director and CEO of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Arizona, and S.E. Smith, Deputy Editor of the Opinion Section at the Daily Dot. S.E. joins us from Fort Bragg, California. Welcome to you both. Thanks for joining us again.
Good morning.
Jim, let me start with you. What's
your
reaction?
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you, S.E. So, Jim, let's start with you. As far as your reaction to what Sergeant Winsky had to say, concerns about law enforcement being involved in this? And if not, are you optimistic about certain areas?
I think he expressed it very well. And, I did talk with some of my law enforcement counterparts prior to coming in. And, you know, there's been... some good and maybe unintended consequences with this legislation. For the most part, I think it helps families and individuals in the community engage in care. We found that, there's actually kind of a backlog a lot of times in the ERs and hospitals with folks with mental illness. And, one of the unintended consequences was maybe the hospitals were too quick to try to call the police in to try to get people out of ERs instead of maybe looking at other interventions. But I know that in our community, there's a group that's actively looking at that as well. But the CIT part, and especially the part where he said it's not just training the officers, but it's kind of educating and informing the community how to use those precious resources, makes a huge difference.
S.E., what are your thoughts in general about that?
I have some concerns, primarily because law enforcement officers are not mental health providers and shouldn't be put in that position. This is a larger national issue, and obviously as a stopgap, programs like the one he was talking about are a really great measure, because I'd rather have officers trained in dealing with mentally ill people than approaching situations with no training. But I feel like laws like this reinforce the idea that police officers should be an integral part of the mental health system. And that comes with a number of dangers.
And I'm glad S.E. brought that up, because that's another piece that we're looking at, is that the police are doing far too many behavioral health interventions in the community that should be done by the mental health mobile teams or behavioral health prevention. And so we're even looking at why are they doing these, and when does it actually take a police intervention as opposed to a behavioral health person that knows and can do something a little bit more productive.
I want to have you both address this. S.E., let me start with you. One thing that Sergeant Winsky mentioned was this idea that the officers or the mental health support team are not wearing traditional uniforms. Does that actually sound like something that would have a big impact to you, the idea that it doesn't look like police are sort of coming at someone in a mental health crisis?
Clearly, there are benefits to that. Many mentally ill people get nervous around police, understandably, because mentally ill people get shot by police on a fairly routine basis. I do think that there are some pitfalls there for people who are undergoing psychotic episodes and who are paranoid, that when they're approached by people who are not in uniform, who seem to kind of have a nebulous role, that may kind of exacerbate what's going on for the patient, who may become agitated, at which point you could get into an escalating situation. So if police officers and other mental health intervention teams are not really trained in proper de-escalation, that can get ugly very, very quickly.
I think that's a great point. You know, and the other point that when we work with the law enforcement, they always make is, you know, once they show up on scene, they're in charge, you know, and it's too late to try to say, you know, this is my loved one. They don't really mean anything. You know, if you want to try to give them some extra instruction, you got to meet them down the street. You got to do that ahead of time. And unfortunately, sometimes even family members may exaggerate the level of threat just to try to expedite a response. So we really have to be careful. Think twice before we bring the police involved.
Jim, how much of this, I mean, so many things when it comes to funding, it's so much about funding. Do we have enough? And if we had more funding, would we be in a position where we would get more mental health professionals as opposed to trying to make officers be better at this, even when they don't have an expertise, like Essie mentioned?
You know, funding is a piece of it, but a lot of it is just focus and attention. You know, there are some basic standards that, you know, behavioral health system usually follows or can follow. There's some communication protocol. There's some things that can be done between agencies to work more effectively and partner that doesn't necessarily take extra money.
Are there things that you would recommend they do?
There are things that are being done even today. It's okay. Kind of exciting.
Please go ahead.
I really can't speak ahead of that, unfortunately, but I think there'll be some good news shortly, hopefully.
Essie, let me come back to you on that. What are your thoughts about this idea of, I mean, just if it's not necessarily financial resources, just extra attention paid to this so that, again, you're putting, as you mentioned, you're putting law enforcement in a position where even with the best of training, it's training on top of other training they've received, which may be contrary to the new training.
Funding is definitely an issue, as I agree with Jim, but the larger thing to consider is social attitudes. Many people think of mental illness as criminal behavior, and the criminalization of mental illness has led people to think that law enforcement are the most appropriate agency to be handling mentally ill people, and we need to shift that attitude around and get people thinking of it as an actual health issue and a health crisis, and to get counselors and mental health experts who can really respond to these issues more appropriately out there. I think I've used this metaphor before, but I'm very fond of it. When someone breaks a leg in the street, you don't call the cops, you call an ambulance, mm-hmm. because you want paramedics, not police officers. And the same thing holds true for mental illness, except that instead of paramedics, you want a mental health response team.
Essie, House Bill 2105, which is what passed in Arizona earlier this year, in part takes witness statements into account when determining whether to take someone experiencing a mental health crisis into custody. And as Jim mentioned, sometimes a family member maybe didn't exaggerate, but I don't know. I guess I will say unintentionally exaggerate a situation, for example. Does that concern you that witnesses will have a larger role in a situation like this?
Yes, it definitely does, for a couple of reasons, the most obvious of which is that it could become a tool for abuse. There's kind of a long historical record of accusing people of having symptoms of mental illness or of being mentally ill as a tool for dismissing or controlling them. A somewhat extreme example is that of suffragettes in the 19th and early 20th centuries, where family members had them incarcerated in mental health institutions by arguing that they were crazy, and they really played no active role in their health care at all. I think there's also a risk that people may start suppressing symptoms around friends, family, and other community members because they may be afraid of being reported to law enforcement. And it makes me a little concerned to hear that people might be afraid to report, because that implies to me that mentally ill people might not know who witnesses are and what they are saying, which doesn't really give them a chance to interact with law enforcement and discuss the issue with them and to say, well, this person reported this. I can understand where that concern comes from, but here's what was going on. So it becomes kind of one-sided, which is an ongoing issue with how people interact with mental illness topics.
Jim, we don't have much time left. I don't want to get your final thoughts on that. HB 2105 passed with very little opposition. Overall, do you like the legislation? Were there some tweaks you would have liked?
You know, I think it was actually common sense. You know, it's basically what they've been doing all along with criminogenic behavior, and this gives them an opportunity now, and maybe instead of just, you know, I can either you know, lock them up or leave, you know, we can help them engage in some type of treatment. I think there is potential for abuse on any number of fronts. It really is going to take some ongoing intentional partnering to make sure that it's a bonus for both sides of the, I guess, both sides of the equation.
Jim Dunn, Executive Director and CEO of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Arizona, and S.E. Smith, Deputy Editor of the Opinion Section at the Daily Dot. S.E. joined us from Fort Bragg, California. Thanks to you both. We appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk with Arizona Republic reporter Caitlin McGlade about a new water agreement announced between Phoenix and Tucson. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Business Journal, presenting Mark Fidelman, 10 Digital Hacks Every Marketer Should Know, October 7th from 9:30 a.m. to 11 at the Arizona Historical Society. Tickets at phoenixbusinessjournal.com/events.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Should be a sunny and clear afternoon in the valley, a high near 90 degrees. More sunshine tomorrow with a high of 92 and about the same for the rest of the week. Clear skies and warmer with highs of 97 on Friday and 99 on Saturday. Join us at 12 o'clock for NPR's Here and Now. Today, health officials aren't ruling out the possibility that more people with Ebola will arrive in the U.S., and authorities in mainland China are rounding up people for supporting pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. Here and Now from Boston starts today at noon. It's sunny and 82 degrees in Phoenix at 11:41.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Earlier this morning, Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton and Tucson Mayor Jonathan Rothschild announced a new Phoenix-Tucson-Colorado River partnership. They're saying it's part of protecting the cities from drought and addressing the effects of climate change. Arizona Republic reporter Caitlin McGlade has been following the story and joins me now. Hi, Caitlin. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
So what's at the heart of the agreement? What do we need to know about what was said today by the mayors?
Essentially, the city council will be voting today an agreement that would allow Phoenix to store its excess water that it is allotted by the Central Arizona Project from the Colorado River in Tucson aquifers. Phoenix does not have the well infrastructure to be able to store as much water as it is allotted, so this allows the city to save up its water supply to prepare for shortages in the Colorado River.
I'm curious about the idea that they can have an agreement like this, in essence, because we have the Colorado River Compact where the states have the agreements. Is there some complication with this, or is this fairly easily done if the council approves it?
Well, I talked to the CAP, and they said that this deal is between the city of Phoenix and the city of Tucson. And definitely, I mean, obviously, the Colorado River is split up among seven states. But cities do have the ability to, stock up their water supply that they are allotted by the CAP so that they can, as the mayor said, take charge of their own destiny when the Colorado River runs low.
And how many details will the city council get today? I guess Councilperson Williams, also Councilman Bill Gates, were scheduled to attend the press conference. Does that mean this is sort of a bipartisan effort of sorts?
Yes, it appears so. The mayor said that that the decision was likely to go through, but we'll find out today.
Okay, and the time frame. Another detail: if the council does give its approval, is there a time frame for how long this will take to implement?
Yeah, it will launch within the year. Actually, there's two phases to it. The first phase would essentially store 3,000 store water that would be enough to do 3,000 homes in about a year. And this is excess water that the city doesn't use. So the city only uses about 2/3 of its water that is allotted. So this will store the majority of the rest of that in Tucson. And then as the agreement advances over the years, the city may help Tucson invest in its infrastructure so that they can store more.
Yeah, I wonder, are there any changes that could potentially be built in if, for some reason, we get out of this drought, or for some reason, which we certainly expect, the mayors will change and perhaps attitudes about this will change?
I am not certain. I just know that this is a pilot program. So it definitely is up for change in future years, being that Phoenix is the first city that is doing something like this in its area.
Did conservation come up at all?
Not too much, although Phoenix has been talking to the water services director. Phoenix has done a lot with water conservation. She told me that per capita, the amount of water used is down by 27% over the past 20 years, and that's part and due by city initiatives and also residential awareness.
Kaylin, one last thing I wanted to ask you about. In the press release that was sent out by the mayor's office, the phrase was mentioned, addressing the effects of climate change. Did that come up specifically, or is just this concept that if Phoenix can store water in Tucson, that's one way of sort of brunting the effect there?
It's one way of buffering the effect that these shortages that are likely to happen to the Colorado River would have an effect here in Phoenix. It basically buffers them to be able to continue to expand economically and attract more investors. To say that we have this water supply. Yes, we know the Colorado River is low, but we have this this finite amount of water we can depend on.
Arizona Republic reporter Kaylin McGlade. Kaylin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. The television sports landscape is changing and expanding rapidly. ESPN, which dominates the field, has been joined by Fox Sports One, the NBC Sports Network, and the CBS Sports Network. But despite the presence of a growing number of female anchors and reporters, all of the talking head and roundtable programs have been led by men. Last night, that started to change a bit.
For the first time, the women of the sports world, together on one show. We Need to Talk, Tuesday at 10 on CBS Sports Network.
We Need to Talk made its debut last night on the CBS Sports Network. With me now to discuss what kind of impact the program could have on sports broadcasting is Vicki Michaelis, University of Georgia professor and a former sports writer for USA Today and the Denver Post. Hi, Vicki. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Steve. An honor to be here.
So what's the most promising thing about We Need to Talk?
The most promising thing to me is that there's a major network giving their investment and resource to this concept that women's opinions, women's sports broadcasters' opinions in particular, are valuable and worth putting on the air.
It has been something, and not to pigeonhole too much, but although it seems like many females in sports have been, there are a lot of great female sports writers, a lot of sideline reporters, a lot of folks on ESPN, but there haven't been, as these pundit shows sort of grow, we haven't really seen as much of a presence of women on that. So I guess I wonder, is this a good sign that a show with all women as opposed to getting more women in some of the programs, let's say Around the Horn on ESPN, for example? We see women occasionally, but they're never the majority.
Right. Yeah, for instance, Around the Horn, we see Jackie McMullen on a regular basis, but we often don't see anyone besides Jackie McMullen. You know, I kind of go both ways on this, Steve. I think it's really important that women be mixed in with what already exists, what's out there. And I think we're actually seeing that happen a little bit with the NFL discussions. NPR actually did a story, I believe it was last week, on ESPN and its treatment of women sports broadcasters and the fact that Jane McManus, who's done some wonderful work for ESPNW on the NFL issues, was sitting at that roundtable after Goodell's press conference. And so I think we're starting to see that. Rachel Nichols, who used to work for ESPN, now at CNN, has done some really great, you know, hard-hitting interviews. Floyd Mayweather, and of course she really made her presence known at the Goodell press conference. Those things are huge steps for women sports broadcasters especially. And so I like to see them just being part of what's out there and what's happening. You get a bit concerned when you have an all-female show like this that they're ghettoizing them in some ways. You know, it's kind of like back in the old days when they used to only cover women's sports in a certain section on certain days in the newspaper. That happened when I was at the Denver Post. Tuesdays were the days we covered women's sports. And it was great that there was a forum for it at all. But on the other hand, you think, really, you know, women's sports happen every day, and shouldn't they just be part of the mix? It should be something where if this story rises to the level, let's put it on the front page of sports and not worry about whether it's a Tuesday.
And Vicki, there's often been the discussion, too, about the pressure of being on television, for example. Radio, newspapers, for males or females, really doesn't matter what people look like. But on TV, there's that pressure, especially for women, to look a certain way. Is this something that could be a problem here, or is this something that could in some ways dash that and make people think less about that and think more about the content?
You know, I think it's an interesting question to raise because it's, of course, a question we'd like to just brush aside and say that doesn't exist, does it? That people care about what you look like and that they're only going to weigh your opinion if you look a certain way. But it definitely exists on TV. And I think women sports broadcasters especially have to meet a totally different standard than the male sports broadcasters in terms of how they look. And, you know, when you look at the lineup that they had last night, they had some beautiful women out there. And I was happy to see, you know, the resumes of those women really sort of surpass their beauty, which is what you really need, is you need to have women who have incredible credibility. But I would hope that that doesn't become something where, you know, you have to meet the standard in order to be on our show. That would not send the right message or do the things, you know, change the things that we need to change.
Vicki, I want to squeeze in one more question. We've got about a minute left. How much pressure do you think there is to be part of a groundbreaking, pioneering program like this? I look at the fact that it's on the CBS Sports Network, which is not CBS, the main network. I'm wondering if this will give them more time to sort of work out the kinks and they won't look at ratings quite so much.
I hope so. I mean, I hope they get more time, more, you know, more leeway in terms of what they can do and what the ratings need to be because of being in that niche. I don't know. I think that because of the profile of it, because it is breaking ground, I think there's probably not going to be as much patience as they might want to have. And I hope that means that they're able to get past things pretty quickly and prove that it's a worthy forum, or at least show everyone that, you know, these opinions are out there and they should be mixed in to all these other shows that exist.
Vicki Michaelis is a University of Georgia professor, also a former sports writer for USA Today and the Denver Post. Vicki, thanks for squeezing us in for a few minutes. We appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thanks, Steve.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The concept of liberal arts education is at least somewhat based on the idea of an openness to learning more about literature, language, history, and philosophy, among other subjects, but has an increase in accessible technology used by kids at a very young age changed how they learn and how they access the broad nature of liberal arts. Stephen J. Tepper is the dean of ASU's Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts. In a recent edition of the Chronicle of Higher Education, he wrote an essay titled Thinking Bigger Than Me in the Liberal Arts.
I think today, compared to even 10 or 20 years ago, there's even a greater focus on building self-confidence, on treating the young student as the center of attention. And so Bigger Than Me is really a way of thinking about a set of experiences that feel very different than what these students expect in their lives. A set of experiences that force them to stop, to turn off, to slow down, to consider the world beyond themselves, and to consider what their contribution to that world can be.
Is the concept of self-education or expanding one's own creativity, if that means sort of locking yourself in a room and getting out a camera or using your iPad or whatever it may be to create something, are we getting to a point where creativity is too solo and then it becomes, wow, look what a great thing I did, as opposed to something that'll instruct others or benefit others?
All creative work has some social component, but technology certainly has allowed people to work more in isolation and less part of sort of emergent collaborative teams. So a great example of that from my hometown of Nashville is the studio musician. So when, you know, even a decade ago, the typical recording was produced in one of Nashville's famous studios, where a group of four or five or six musicians would come together. And today, much of the music in Nashville is made in home studios, where a producer will send you a song and say, you know, I need a guitar section for this part of the song. Send it back to me. I'll edit it together with other pieces of music that I've that have been sent to me virtually. So that idea of sort of emergent creative collaborative work, I think, is less frequent than it used to be, enabled by technology, certainly.
So this survey that's been taken for the past six decades or so, I'm a very important person. Can you give us some background on that and how it's changed?
Yeah, so this is one of the most remarkable, I think, statistics that one can find. About five decades ago, we started asking high school seniors a question about, do you think you're a very important person? And asked, how many people agree with that statement. It was well below 20% agreed with that statement back then. And that percentage has grown by five or six times. Now the vast majority of young people say, yes, I am a very important person. Very rarely do we see statistical change of that magnitude. And so I think it really is quite telling about the sort of psychology of young people. And of course they are very important people. But again, it's this idea of technology increasingly allows them, to be at the center of their universe. So, market researchers call this, I want what I want, when and how I want it generation. The experiences that pull a person out of their sense of self into the broader world require them to give themselves over to an experience, right? Which often requires them to trust that some curator has an idea that's important and that they need to go through the process of engaging that experience or that idea, even if it feels unfamiliar, if it's not convenient, if it's not about them.
There are some who criticize this all kids are winners thing, the idea that all kids get trophies and that kind of thing. And presumably that's exaggerated to some extent, but there is some feeling that. Does that make it harder as a liberal arts educator when you have this idea that every drawing that my parents put on the refrigerator is great? Or is that sort of a growth arc mm-hmm. that students go through?
It does make it challenging in some respects. I mean, it is great that students come with confidence. And from confidence, they can be effective and productive in all kinds of important ways that matter in education. One of the, I think, important lessons that you learn in any good liberal arts education is that your first idea is not the best idea. And this notion of sort of failing and listening to feedback and figuring out what you didn't do right and being prepared for radical revision of your ideas and your work, I think it's harder to get there given where students are starting today. So you almost have to really put them in a sort of extraordinary context for them to be prepared to hear that kind of feedback, to radically revise, to be willing to fail. I mean, I think that idea that everybody deserves a trophy is reflected in, the massive grade inflation we've seen throughout higher ed, where students really think that if they dot all the I's and cross all the T's, that they should have an A. In my book, the A is for that student who has that extra bit of curiosity, who takes the material given, but then tries to think about it in new ways, or they're curious enough to want to follow up and come see you and ask you, how does this idea connect to this idea? That's what I think it takes to have an A.
Coming from a prominent private university like Vanderbilt to a prominent public university, what differences, if any, do you expect to see in terms of the perspective on the bigger than me?
I think the opportunities, at a major public institution are greater, frankly. The private university like Vanderbilt has incredible privileges in terms of access to resources. Some of the students that score the highest on standardized testing, but in many ways. I sort of felt this way as a faculty member. You can be good at your job and you can be engaging, but in some ways you're a little bit irrelevant to the student's pathway. To get into Vanderbilt, they are already on a successful pathway, and many of them come from families with resources, and they're going to be successful when they leave because of the relationships and networks and resources that they have access to. At a place like Arizona State University, where when students arrive here, I mean, they're so hungry for this experience. They've dreamt about, being at Arizona State University or the University of Arizona. And they're bringing that kind of, that passion with them. Now, we can lose them, right? We can put them through a series of sequences and steps that feel very much about, you know, getting the grade, a frenetic schedule, moving from one thing to the next thing, sort of dancing like a product on an assembly line, right? Or we can try and enchant them or further enchant them, because they're arriving with the sense that this is a magical place. Mm-hmm. We can't squander that.
Stephen J. Tepper, Dean of ASU's Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts. That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, also Bruce Drummond. Thank you very much for listening.